it truly impugns their integrity to proclaim the gospel as they think the gospel should be proclaimed, then they can decide what they want to do in terms of staying within the PCUSA.
The change affects more than 11,000 congregations nationwide with about 2.8 million members. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
American International Group is joining the federal government in offering to sell 300 million AIG shares to the public. Their regulatory filing today didn't say how much each share would go for, but yesterday their closing price was just under $30. The government owns about 92% of AIG. It has said it would recoup the billions of dollars in bailout money it gave the insurance giant at the height of the financial crisis. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Some say a year after the death of singer and songwriter Kate McGarrigle, the first two CDs she made with her sister Anna in the 70s have been reissued along with a CD of their demos. On the next Fresh Air, Anna talks about Kate and those early McGarrigle sisters' recordings, including Anna's most famous song, Heart Like a Wheel. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm David Thiel from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. In January of 1811, hundreds of slaves, dressed in military uniforms and armed with a variety of weapons, set out from sugar plantations north of New Orleans with the goal of conquering the city. This was the biggest slave revolt in American history. It's something known as the German Coast Uprising. Hundreds were involved. More than 100 slaves were killed. Yet it's an event that was largely written out of American history. Our guest for the program this morning, Daniel Rasmussen, has written a book about this, and we'll be talking about it. The title of his book is American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Harper is the publisher, and he first came across references to it when he was an undergraduate at Harvard reading American history. And it really struck him, a couple of things struck him, the fact that he read references to this thing, that it happened, that it was the biggest slave uprising in American history, and yet it seemed that nothing was known about it. So he started to do some research, ended up writing his senior thesis about it, won a prize for undergraduate research, and then expanded. He took that and expanded it, and the result is the book that we'll be talking about this morning. And Mr. Rasmussen, hello.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's a great story. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about how it is that you came across the story.
Yeah, so the revolt has been acknowledged as the largest slave revolt in American history since 1943, but almost nobody has written about it, and that's because essentially the primary sources that are most accessible, the letters and newspaper accounts, are very biased. They're written by the governor and by the planters, who were trying to say that this revolt was insignificant, that the slaves were mere brigands or criminals, and that essentially the rest of the country shouldn't pay attention to this. Louisiana was up for statehood at the time, and these planters and the governor did not want this story getting out. So what I had to do, was dig much further, do a lot more extensive research, build databases, map those databases onto land maps, and use tools like Google Maps in addition to lots and lots of archival research to dig out the true story of what happened.
Yeah, and I think that it's certainly true that the thing that slaveholders in the South feared the most was an uprising, a slave uprising. So clearly they also, one of the reasons they had for wanting to keep this story quiet is they would not have wanted, no one would have wanted slaves elsewhere to hear this and be inspired by it.
Absolutely. There is a paranoia in the South about slave revolts that was a driving political force for much of the 19th century. And really what went into this was when they tried to suppress the story, they suppressed it because the idea of black slaves rising up, putting on military uniforms, flying flags, saying, not only are we no longer slaves, but we're free and we're politically active, we have a real political vision of what we want to achieve, was so threatening to the fundamental ideology of American slavery, which was that these slaves weren't people, that they were mere chattel. And so they tried to keep that story down in order to suppress that very powerful idea.
Yeah. It's certainly one of the things that's striking here is how close, maybe still that would have been a long way from achieving the goal that they had in mind, not only taking the city but setting up a black republic on the banks of the Mississippi. They did come within, I think, 15 miles of New Orleans before they were stopped by hastily organized militia, and probably the reason that they were beaten so badly is that they were outgunned, not really that they were outfought.
Exactly. You know, so what happens really, you know, the slaves march, they come within 15 miles of the city, and people often ask, you know, did they have any chance of success? And I found this wonderful letter from the commodore in the city, and he says that the American military only had 68 regular troops in the city. He calls them a weak detachment. And he writes that the rest of the city is essentially unarmed. So you have, you know, 200 to 500 black slaves who know that if they are defeated, they'll be tortured and killed, facing off against a relatively small detachment of American troops protecting a defenseless city. And at that moment, when they're within 15 miles of the city, they're focused on that military, and that military marches out to meet them. And they lure them out. They trick them into attacking a home, an empty plantation that they've abandoned. And then they retreat back into the countryside and are flanked unwittingly by a planter militia that had risen up upriver of them. And so they'd just been focused on attacking New Orleans. They hadn't realized that there's a threat coming from behind.
Yeah.
And those, they face off in this dramatic battle in the cane fields.
Part of the story here that's really interesting is that this was something, I suppose nobody really knows how long it was in the planning, but this was something for which there was careful planning and careful choice of when it was that the uprising took place for a number of reasons, and we can talk some more about the context, but part of the reason that they chose the time that they did was, in fact, the best of the American troops that were based in New Orleans had been sent out of the city into, I guess, what is actually now part of Louisiana, but what was then known as West Florida, which had been recently taken from Spain, and the concern of the people there in New Orleans was that the possibility that Spain was going to try to take it back. So they sent soldiers over there, and they sent their best soldiers and left behind the weakest.
Absolutely. So these slaves are incredibly politically sophisticated. They've built a complex organization, 11 separate leaders across different ethnic groups, planning this revolt over, you know, it's hard to say how long, but to get an uprising of that size, it would have, you know, had to have been planned pretty extensively. And they choose January of 1811 exactly for the reason you stated, which is that America's fighting this war with the Spanish. They've sent the Dragoons, which are the best fighting force, out to Baton Rouge to fight the Spanish. And there's fear. There are widespread rumors of a Spanish counterattack. And so the slaves launched their revolt, figuring that the American military is distracted, and there's hope of outside intervention. But there's one additional reason, which is that New Orleans was then, as it is now, somewhat of a party town. And they launched their revolt just after Epiphany Sunday, which marks the beginning of Carnival. And the build-up to Mardi Gras. So they're launching this revolt at a time when not only are the Americans distracted by this war with the Spanish, but the French planters are distracted by, you know, this season of decadent balls and parties.
Yeah, and also the slaves were assisted here by the weather. Apparently that had been a really bad storm. The roads were very muddy, and as a result then there was no way for the troops to move their artillery out of the city, so the slaves weren't having to look down the barrel of a cannon.
Exactly. That's a huge advantage for these slaves. And so when they're, you know, thinking about these guys armed with muskets, cane knives, axes, facing off against the American military, knowing that they wouldn't have to face artillery because the artillery couldn't be transported in heavy mud was another huge reason why they chose this moment to launch their revolt.
Our guest in this hour, Focus, is Daniel Rasmussen. He's the author of the book American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. It took place 200 years ago, January, last month. The thing known as the German Coast Uprising, the biggest slave revolt in U.S. history. But something for understandable reasons, as he explained, the planters at the time, the government at the time, the white power elite there in Louisiana really wanted to do everything they could to say, well, this wasn't really very important and it wasn't very big. They certainly didn't want slaves elsewhere to get any ideas from it. And for that reason, for a long time, the story was largely forgotten, and he has researched it and has written this book. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about the German coast there in Louisiana, as a place that at least at the time was very big center of sugar production. And apparently there were a lot of large plantations there, and there are a lot of very wealthy people there.
Yep. The German coast is really a fascinating place, you know, a mixture of French and Spanish planters. And you know, more recently, since Louisiana purchased, an influx of American planters. And they're growing sugar, which is a different crop than's grown in the rest of the United States. Sugar can only be grown in very, very warm and tropical climates. So you see it grown largely in the Caribbean islands. New Orleans is just about as far north as it can be planted. And sugar is the most profitable crop to grow. It's also the most brutal crop in terms of the treatment of its workers. There's one planter who writes, "How can we make money growing sugar when we only work our slaves 16 hours a day?" He says the answer is to consume men and animals. And so you have this dramatic, you know, world full of contradictions of great money being made, but also just great cruelty being inflicted. And in these plantations, there's this level of sophistication among the slave population, because you have not only the work of planting and growing the sugar, but you also have to, you know, granulate it. So you have this these factories on each plantation, essentially, where they're boiling the sugar and converting it into you know, the granular form which you're used to seeing. And so, you know, the slave drivers or the leaders of these plantations are used to commanding and leading and running not only the work of planting, but the sort of complex industrial process. And it all creates, you know, this sort of powder keg because you have, you know, gangs of slaves working under other slave leaders in an incredibly brutal place, which is politically unstable because of the ethnic mixture of the, you know, planter class and the intervention of the American government.
The key, there were a number of people who were involved in leading this uprising, but it seemed that maybe one of the key individuals and a person that you really concentrate on was a man named Charles DeLand, who was in fact a slave driver, and people, I'm sure, have heard that expression. That actually was a name for an individual who had a role on the plantation, who was the person who was in between the overseer and the slaves. What did the slave driver do?
The slave driver is responsible for running those gangs of slaves. He punishes the recalcitrant ones. He meets with the master and the overseer every morning to plan what's going to happen on the plantation that day. And slave drivers, like Charles DeLand, were widely regarded as sort of betrayers of the race, men who, in exchange for furthering the system of slavery, for helping their masters, got, you know, better cabins, better clothes, better food, the ability to travel and to, you know, to marry. And Charles was, you know, one of those men. But Charles, unlike many slave drivers, was using his position of power not to assist the system of slavery, but to undermine it. He was sort of this sleeper cell. And so he would travel up and down the coast, ostensibly on his master's business, meeting with a few other key leaders, Cook and Kwamana, or Kwaku and Kwamina in their native Akan tongues, who had just been brought over from Africa about 5 years earlier. These were, you know, men from a really violent, warlike kingdom in Africa, looming warriors that have ritual scars on their faces. And then another man, Harry Kenner, who is an Anglo-American slave, you know, brought from the Northeast down to Louisiana, who spoke English and was familiar with sort of the American ways of operating. And these men would meet, on the edges of plantations, in the swamp, at secret taverns on the levee, and in the African dances that happened in New Orleans to plot their revolt.
Do you have any idea how long this was in the planning?
It's hard to tell. I would have said, you know, many months to years.
Mm. And what it was that inspired them and made them not only to aspire to being free, but to do what they did in the way that they did it?
Yeah. So the slaves actually had this very motivational moment, a beacon of hope to look at, which was that in 1804, the Haitian slaves had fought a 13-year battle against the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte and the French. And they'd overthrown those military, these bands of slaves, defeating the greatest emperor, warlike emperor that Europe has ever seen, Napoleon Bonaparte, and declaring independence for Haiti, establishing a black republic that makes slavery illegal, that makes imperialism illegal, that makes racism illegal. That moment of seeing a successful slave revolt, of seeing them beat back European military forces, is so inspiring to the slaves. And there's a spread of that radical black Republican ideology throughout the New World, but especially in Louisiana. And especially in Louisiana, because Louisiana was paired with Haiti. Those were the those were the twin French colonies of Napoleon. And when Haiti falls, Napoleon sells Louisiana to the United States because he doesn't have any use for it. And so there is a large community of exiles from Haiti that comes to Louisiana. But the French planters in Louisiana see the fall of Haiti, and they start growing sugar here in the United States, creating a sugar colony on the model of Haiti, without realizing the extent to which they're creating the same brutal conditions, the same level of violence that inspired those Haitian slaves to revolt.
Yeah, and certainly everybody would have been familiar with the French Revolution, and that was also something that apparently was in a kind of inspiration to these slaves.
Absolutely. They discovered documents from the French Revolution in the slave quarters, and you have to think that these slaves were very familiar with everything that their masters knew about. They're serving the food. They're the messengers. They're driving the carriages. And so as their masters talk about politics, about their war with the Spanish, about the words of the French Revolution, the idea, the ideology of freedom, and about their fear of a Haitian-style revolt, the slaves are listening. And they're listening and retelling those stories in the slave quarters. And that's, a really complex political society and dialogue going on here in the slave quarters.
You used some research tools that this is not exactly new, but I think maybe within the last decade or so, maybe a little bit more and more people in the social sciences have been using computers and databases and using that as a research tool and as a way of organizing data, and have found it very valuable. And this was something that that you used as well. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, so most of those primary sources that I mentioned are in list forms. They'll say something along the lines of, Charles de Lande is a slave driver worth $700, bought in 1805. He is X feet tall. They're lists. Mm-hmm. A list of financial information. And then the court trials tend to be very sparse as well. They'll say something like, Cook denounced Charles as an infamous brigand and a leader of the revolutionaries. And so in order to process that data, I think a lot of people sort of looked at that and said, well, how do I take this financial data, essentially, and convert it into any sort of narrative story that would be interesting to people? And so what I had to do was take that financial information in order to process it, use those tools of financial analysis that we use today, use Excel, put those databases in, and so creating a line, a row, essentially, for each individual slave. So we could aggregate all of the information from all of the sources, and then to take those databases, to map them, to put them onto old lamp. I was literally in the library, with crayons coloring in. If 5 slaves came from here, I'd color it green. If it was 10 slaves, orange. And then once I had a sort of spatial perspective built out of that databases and the maps, to say, to use military correspondence, diplomatic correspondence that said, at 9 a.m. this thing happened here, and to use Google Maps to figure out where, each individual event, because it would have taken 3 hours to walk from point A to point B, so this other event must have happened at 6 a.m. if the other event happened at 9 a.m., and to triangulate through the use of all of that data and through, those modern tools of research and analysis, exactly what happened and where, and then to invigorate that story, to take that story of raw here, you know, X happened here, Y happened here at this time, and to use travelers' narrative, slave narrative, stories from other revolts, everything I could to make it a readable story and a story that people could relate to and a story that you could feel and experience with the slaves as they marched rather than just a dry academic treatise, even though the research methods were quite dry, arduous, and academic.
Mm. You know, one of the things that you point out, and we'll talk some more about how the story unfolded, was that once the rebellion got going, that the word got out pretty quick, and that slaves had to know that they, in exchange for providing information about the rebellion and the fact that it was happening to their masters, they could expect to be freed. Knowing that, it seems remarkable that this was something that was being plotted for, you said, you know, months, maybe even years, that somehow word of this didn't leak out before it actually started.
It's just a testament to the skill and sophistication of these leaders that the stakes were so high, because anybody that found out about this and betrayed it would have won their freedom. And so they had to be incredibly selective about who they chose to participate. The leaders had to be very, very careful in their planning. And so that's a real testament to their skill and intelligence. But what's also very interesting is that as soon as the revolt began, betrayals also begin. And there is one slave who, you know, not only, his name is Dominique, he not only tells his master and helps his master escape, but then warns almost every single planter from the plantation of Francois Trepanier, about 30 miles outside the city, into New Orleans to flee. And that's one of the reasons why the slaves the slave rebels don't end up killing that many white people. It's because this slave, Dominique, who betrays the revolutionaries, ends up warning so many of the white planters to flee.
That's another thing that's really striking about it. If I recall, I think that only two white planters were killed something like 100 slaves ended up being killed. Only two white planters died?
Yep. You know, according to the official records, I think there are some people would cast doubt on that and suggest that maybe more died, but there's really only records that suggest that two were killed. The first, Manuel Andry, is taken by surprise by Charles Deland and his men, and they kill his son Gilbert. Manuel escapes, although he's scarred severely. And then the other is Francois Trepanier, who's a man who is warned by his slave, but because of his contempt for his slaves, decides to stand and fight. Doesn't realize, just the extent of this insurrection, and is, subsequently killed by the rebels. But all of the other masters flee. And in the battle that happens in the cane fields, you know, turns into a massacre. And it's hard to say why, but I think it's because the slaves run out of ammunition. They aren't as well armed as the planters, and so they fall prey to their superior weaponry.
Let me again introduce our guest. We're about midway through our conversation. Daniel Rasmussen is talking with us this morning. He is the author of the book American Uprising. The subtitle is The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Harper is the publisher. It's just out recently. It's a book that tells the story of the German Coast Uprising. This happened 200 years ago, January 1811, the biggest slave revolt in U.S. history. Hundreds of slaves were involved. And yet, as he explains, it was something that for a long time, while people knew that it had happened, there wasn't a lot of information about it. And that, he argues in the book, is the result of a very deliberate effort to bury the event so that people outside of Louisiana wouldn't know about it, and certainly so slaves elsewhere in the country wouldn't hear about it and draw inspiration from it. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think while it certainly is true that that officially the power structure there in Louisiana did everything they could to minimize this event, that it's something, though, that certainly among people who lived along the German coast was remembered, talked about, memory was preserved. I'm sure that there are people who talk about actually having had ancestors who were involved.
Absolutely. I was down in New Orleans just a few weeks ago speaking about the book, and a woman stood up and she said, you know, thank you so much for writing this book. you know, and I know that you talk about nobody knowing this in the rest of the country, but I just want you to know that I've heard about this for years in my family reunions. And so there's been a powerful oral history of folklore that I talk about in the book that's been preserved for 200 years now. And actually my work and the work of other scholars relies a lot on the work of community activists who went around from courthouse to courthouse assembling all the documents about the revolt. You know, and this was a, you know, it's hard to, you know, going into a Louisiana courthouse, even today as a, you know, an African-American activist and saying, I want to, you know, get all the documents about this slave revolt, was a very brave thing to do in this, you know, rural counties. And really, you know, a heroic job in collecting those documents. And so I actually, you know, spent time with descendants of the revolutionaries and with those local activists to learn from them what I could about the revolt. Mm.
Well, I get you to tell the story, a little bit more of the story of what happened here. And it seems that this revolt did indeed begin on the plantation of this man you mentioned, Manuel Andry, who, and this was also where Charles Deland was the slave driver. We talked a little bit about the context, about how the slaves knew that the best American troops had been sent out of New Orleans and they were fighting some way away. It was the beginning of Carnival, so there was a lot of partying going on, and it seemed to make sense that that would be a good time when people's guard were definitely down. The weather worked against the movement of artillery. And anything else that you think perhaps one can't really know why it is at the moment that it happened, someone decided this was the moment?
You know, it's hard to say beyond. I think those larger political reasons are the most significant. But it's also hard to understate, you know, the brutality of these plantations. The average lifespan of a slave is, you know, 7 years if they've just been brought over from Africa, very short. The levels of punishment inflicted on the slaves include, you know, tying the slaves' hands and feet to stakes and then beating them to an inch of their lives, torture devices like collars with spikes facing inwards so the slaves couldn't sleep, or masks over their mouths so they couldn't eat. And so, you know, in addition to the larger, broader political ideas of freedom, you know, and of those tactical ideas about when the Spanish are going to counterattack, there's also just sort of the instant, immediate reaction, man in revolt against brutality and oppression.
So is there actually a story, I don't know where the story comes from, so on that night the revolt breaks out, Manuel Andry is in bed, in his bedroom, and he wakes up and sees Charles Deland standing there?
With an axe.
With an axe, yep. Yes.
Which is an incredible moment, right, to see, you know, his most loyal, trusted advisor. This guy he'd met with every morning, you know, for a decade to plan the sugar, you know, system, standing there with an axe, this, you know, plantation tool now transmuted into an icon of insurrection. And he sees his slaves in the darkness hacking his son Gilbert to death. And he has the presence of mind to run. And somehow the details in his own accounts are sparse, but he escapes from the slaves. They manage to cut these three long scars into his body, the scars that he'll bear with him for the rest of his life and that he would, you know, tell travelers about who passed by his plantation for years. But he escapes, and he crosses over the river to the other side where there's no revolt taking place, and he rallies the planters there. And he basically warns them that their lives, their livelihood, everything they'd built here on the German coast in New Orleans, was at stake unless they could defeat the slave army. And so even though the slaves, for some reason, let Manuel Andry live, you know, perhaps not thinking of him as a threat because they're so focused on New Orleans, on the American troops there, on attacking that center of power, that they don't realize that this threat then emerges when Andry crosses the river, rallies those planters, crosses back over the river, and then flanks the unwitting army, you know, slave army.
Mm. And it was one of the reasons perhaps why it did start on the Andry plantation, or that it was a good place, was because he was a local militia commander, and I gather that there on the plantation he had in storage guns and uniforms.
Absolutely. That's another, you know, reason why it starts in the Andry state. They, you know, right after they kill Gilbert Andry and they let Manuel escape, they break into that stockpile, they arm themselves, and they put on uniforms. Which is incredibly important to this story, which is, you know, why are these slaves putting on militia uniforms? And what they're doing is they're laying claim to a political, they're making a political statement. They're saying, you know, we're no longer just slaves, we're men, we're fighters, and we're standing for a real political identity and evoking sort of the imagery of the Haitian Revolution. And that, you know, you don't see in other revolutions in the United States. You know, it's incredibly powerful, this idea of slaves in uniforms, marching in military formation, flying flags, beating drums, shouting on to New Orleans and freedom or death. Just incredibly inspiring and different in a way than what else, you know, what you see in Nat Turner's revolt or John Brown's revolt.
And is it known how many there were in this army, in this slave army?
So eyewitness accounts say between 200 and 500. Hmm. It depends on who's making the accounting. Of those, about 125 of them, I have actual documented records of their participation. You know, somewhere between 200 or 500.
And what proportion of the total number of slaves would this have been?
About 25%.
Hmm. So that's pretty significant if a quarter of them were involved.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and it just speaks to, you know, how effective these leaders were in rallying such a huge force. You know, and there is still that 75% that chooses not to participate. And I think, you know, there's when we speak about these slave populations, it's important to realize just how much debate there would have been about something like this. And you can just imagine those moments when the army is coming, the slave army is coming, they're going to overthrow the white, you know, military power. And there are slaves in their quarters coming out, seeing this army in military uniform, you know, who had overthrown, who had driven all of the planters out from all, you know, all of their plantations. They'd literally seen their masters hightail it and flee for the city. And having to make that decision of, am I going to stand and fight and risk my life and the lives of my family members to participate in this rebellion? Or am I going to stay behind, you know, seek the safety of my own cabin, let this pass and see where the chips fall? And I think a lot of people make what I think is probably the rational decision, which is let's wait and see. But had that revolt succeeded, had they been able to defeat that army of 68 regular troops and take New Orleans, I think you would have seen a much larger portion than just that 200 to 500 rally with the slave rebels. And that's certainly what happened in Haiti.
Well, I suppose that gets to the question, though, even a well-armed slave army of 500, whether in fact this ultimate goal that they had of taking control of the city of New Orleans and then setting up some sort of independent black republic, whether such a thing could even have in anybody's wildest imagination have been successful, and even if they had succeeded in kind of short term, whether they actually thought that the United States would leave them alone.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is amazing that they thought they could win. You know, what would have happened next? I mean, I think America would have thrown every military power it had at New Orleans.
Sure.
To try to, you know, prevent that and to suppress it and to eliminate that black republic. And so I think that's why the sort of international political situation is so important. You know, the slaves, first of all, had seen Haitian slaves. I mean, who would have thought that a bunch of Haitian slaves could defeat Napoleon's armies? But they did. And so, you know, there's that inspiration. But there's also, I think, in the slaves' minds, the hope that the Spanish or the British will intervene, right? This is just, a year before the War of 1812. Everybody knows about those international tensions between the Americans and the British. And everybody's, you know, especially New Orleans, is very aware of, you know, the war that America's been fighting with the Spanish armies over West Florida. And so I think that there's hope on the slaves' part, whether that hope was misplaced or well-conceived, that there would be outside military intervention.
Well, again, about 15 minutes left in this conversation with Dan Rasmussen. The book is American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. The book is published by Harper, out now, and questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you talked about how what happened here, how the revolt began, that the slaves broke into the military stores there at the Andrea Plantation. They took muskets. They put on uniforms. If there weren't enough guns, people picked up whatever kind of weapon they could, and they started marching toward New Orleans. They met they were met by the American troops. Initially, there was some fighting. The American troops fell back, but that was a kind of a ruse, so that then the planter militia that had been raised by Manuel Andre could get around behind them. So there was this, in the cane fields there, there was this really savage battle, which the slaves lost. And then they were dealt with most brutally by the planters. What happened there in the aftermath?
Yes, so the slaves meet the planters in the field of battle, and there's a Spanish spy who writes, the blacks were not intimidated by this army, and they formed themselves in a line. The slaves formed this firing line to face off against the militia. And in those moments, finally fighting against, you know, their oppressors, the planters, and in the heat of battle, in the smoke and chaos as the guns fire, the planters break the slave line, and they begin one of the most horrific massacres in American history. They chase down the slaves. They kill 40 to 60 of them right there. They scare others into the swamps and pursue them with military force into the swamps. They kill, over the next few days, about 100 slaves, and then ritually, systematically, collectively, they behead each of the slaves they've killed, and they take their heads to the levees, and they put them up on poles. There's a planter, Samuel Hambleton, who writes, the slaves were brung here for the sake of their heads, which decorate the levee all the way up the coast. They look like crows sitting on long poles, turning this land of sugar, this profitable enterprise zone, into this horrific landscape of death and mutilation. They catch Charles de Lande. They chop off his limbs, they shoot him in both thighs, and then they burn him alive. It's gruesome, and it speaks to the level of fear that these planters had of what their slaves would do and could achieve. You don't kill 100 slaves, each slave costing roughly $30,000 in American, you know, present-day American currency. You don't destroy that much of your own property unless you are terrified, and they are terrified of what would have happened, of what could have happened, had this revolt succeeded or spread.
So we know that maybe about 100 or so were executed in this way. There were hundreds that took part in this. Do you know, or does anybody know, were there in fact slaves who took part in this uprising that then just ended up going back to the plantations where they had lived and resuming something like the life that they had before? I mean, what happened on the plantations afterwards?
So there's, you know, between 100 and 400 slaves who do exactly that. They fade back into plantation life, and the planters don't know. They can't figure out, you know, who participated and who they should kill or who they shouldn't kill. They feel like they've made a great example, but they don't want to overdo it because, again, these slaves are very valuable. So after killing 100 slaves, there are survivors, men who pass on the story to their children, who tell the story of Charles de Lande, of Cook and Quamana, and really make a story of martyrdom that becomes an inspiration for the slaves up and down the German coast. But there are also men that I think, you know, learn from this, that we don't see another revolt of this size in Louisiana. And that's precisely because those heads on poles and that brutality are very, do speak to the slaves about the dangers of insurrection and just, you know, to what extent the planters and the American government will go to prevent any sort of insurrection.
And did the plantation owners do anything different after that to lessen the possibility that such another uprising could be organized?
Absolutely. So in other revolts, like Nat Turner, you see a sort of soul-searching among the planter class of men asking, should we really be doing this? Are we mistreating our slaves? And you do not see that here in New Orleans. What you instead see is the planters going to the American government. The planters have been very hostile to American authority here in Louisiana. They had been very recalcitrant about participating in American civic institutions, had been unwilling to have, you know, American troops stationed there. And they go to the next meeting of the House of Representatives. The Speaker of the House gets up and he says, "We shall cling to the United States as an ark of safety." And all they do, they don't question the system of slavery, they don't try to ameliorate it. All they do is they ask that federal troops be sent down to New Orleans to protect them. So all they say is, let's arm ourselves to the teeth. In the face of this slave revolt, we're just going to get more American military down here to protect us, and we're going to side with the Americans in a way that we haven't before, start participating in their militias, start, you know, accepting their form of government, participating in the state, in order to guarantee our own safety. And that story is really a microcosm of what you see throughout the South, in the Southwest, which is this deal that the Americans make, that we will protect the system of slavery, we will help the system of slavery expand in exchange for the economic benefits and the loyalties and of the planters throughout the South.
Yeah.
And that's really what makes the American South.
And that's really another interesting feature here, that as you argue in the book, that before this, maybe the French planters weren't all that comfortable with the Americans. They didn't like the governor, the American governor, William Claiborne. But what happened as a result of the revolt, it really pushed the French into the arms of the Americans and the American military. And the result was that the white population pulled together, united by their fear of the blacks.
Exactly. And that story of the influence of slave politics, which is what it is, right? Slave politics on American society is huge. And you see that fear of slave revolt driving not only that consolidation of American power and that, you know, particular form of, you know, a marriage of economic development with federal military power in the South, but also driving larger political developments in the South. The Declaration of Independence, for example, is a list of grievances. The penultimate grievance is that the British Crown has incited domestic insurrections among us. So what does that mean? Well, there's a reason that these Virginians, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, are participating in that revolt, and that is that King George has threatened to use black troops to maintain order in Virginia. And that is so worrisome to these planters, whose livelihood depend on slavery, that they decide to secede from the British in order to secure their own system of slavery. Fast forward to South Carolina Ordinances of Secession. The final grievance they have enlisting their reasons to secede from the Union is that Northern abolitionists have incited domestic insurrections against us. They're talking about John Brown, but they're also talking more broadly about that fear of events like the 1811 revolt. And they're thinking, what do we need to do to protect our livelihoods and our lifestyles from our own slaves?
So you talked about what happened afterwards, after the revolt failed, that some 100 slaves were killed. They were beheaded. They put their heads on poles as an example to other slaves to show what would happen if such a thing was attempted again. So that was one level of the response. But what were some of the other things that the white power structure of the time did to minimize the significance of this event?
Well, two things. So they do. They held a series of court trials, and these are really kangaroo courts. And what they're trying to say is these slaves are not revolutionaries. They're just criminals, and they're criminals who are subject to our legal system, and our legal system is still in force. It's a way of reassuring the planters that amidst this savagery, this brutality of these beheadings, that they are on the side of righteousness, of the law. And so they hold these trials, and then they basically do the exact same thing which the planters have done before the trials, which is to execute everyone who was put on trial and behead them too. And then, you know, I think the second response is a literate response, a way of making sense of the violence. And that's in these letters, these newspaper accounts, in which the planters write and say, nothing really happened. We're in control. We've made a great example of these slave revolutionaries. There's nothing to be seen here. There's nothing to worry about. These slaves were just criminals. And that collective suppression of the story, that dehumanizing and depoliticizing of the actions of the slave rebels, ends up being a very successful strategy for keeping this story suppressed and preventing, for nearly 200 years, this story from being told to a broader audience in the United States.
Yeah, it's really striking. We talked earlier about the fact that people who lived around there remembered the story. And within, it's passed down through families, the story was passed down. It just seems to me that this must have been, at the time, a huge event and something that would have gotten national, even in the media of the time, would have gotten national coverage.
It would have. And, you know, you do see newspapers all over the country that do report on it. But because the reports are so sparse, remember, New Orleans is sort of on the fringe. It's out in the extremities of the American nation. there's not that much more information that they can get about it other than those letters and those newspaper accounts. And so will newspapers all across the country reprint those accounts? There's no real powerful abolitionist press or black press in the North which says we need to figure out more about this or learn more about it. They sort of take on trust the stories they're getting from New Orleans because they really can't do any sort of independent reporting. And there's, you know, no other way of getting information from this sort of imperial colony on the fringes of the American government.
It's just a remarkable story. And again, I guess I find myself thinking not so much about just how dramatic and horrific the events were, but what the atmosphere afterward must have been like. And that you would think if the plantation owners were brutal before, it would have been even worse, that the climate of fear on both sides would have been even more afterward than it had been before.
Absolutely. There's this tension, this paranoia, this fear implicit in everyday action, right? Because the slaves do everything. They really do. They build the levees. They run the plantations. They serve the food. And you can only imagine the planters sitting at their tables in their plantations, eating five-course meals, looking out the windows at the beheaded bodies of their slaves, while simultaneously fearing nervously just, you know, those eyes looking at them of their slaves and not knowing what's going on, what will happen next. And that's looking really to, you know, militias, to the federal military, and to the symbol of those heads on pikes, and to extreme brutality. There's a folklore tradition that suggests that there was a wave of sexual violence unleashed on the female slaves after the revolt in order to, you know, further remind them of where power lay. Whatever happens, you know, this is such a combustible environment. And the entire system of slavery throughout the South really is these planters sitting on this powder keg. And that's why you see these whippings, these punishments, these constant rumors of slave insurrection and actual slave insurrection, because the planters are so, so worried about the possibility that their own slaves will rise up against them and kill them, just as Charles de Lande and Kukulcumana did in 1811.
And I'm sure that for them, certainly slaves ran away or tried to run away all the time. And you can imagine isolated cases of perhaps a slave who had the opportunity to strike out would have. But something on this order, something that was so organized, something that actually seemed to have a kind of a political, immoral and political ideology driving it, that must have really been frightening.
It was, and that's why they go to such a great extent through these court trials, these letters, newspaper accounts, to reiterate at every possible turn that the slaves are not revolutionaries, that they're criminals. They repeat it over and over again. These slaves are brigands. They call them a horde of brigands. They're brigands. You just see that word over and over again. And it's sort of this conscious strategy of, you know, a narrative strategy to say, you know, we don't want to acknowledge these men are political and that they're revolutionary, that they are fighting in some sense for the same ideals that we believe in, which are freedom and equality. But freedom and equality as ideals in the hands of the slaves are so threatening to the system of American government, American slavery in the United States at this time.
Did you come across anybody who was actually willing to say, as a result of this, to voice concerns about slavery, the entire system, just being untenable and unsustainable and incredibly dangerous?
Yeah, so you actually do not see that, and that's one of the most unique things about this revolt. You really do not see anything like that happening in New Orleans. There's nobody who questions it. However, outside of the country, outside of New Orleans, you do see northern newspapers which say, you know, which do raise questions. And they say, you know, let's look at this brutality. Are we really sure we want Louisiana to be a state? But again, we're looking at, you know, sort of 5 or 10 newspapers in Maine and Boston and Vermont that, you know, they are voicing it, but it never really picks up momentum. And actually, even though Louisiana is up for statehood that very month, this never enters the congressional record as a topic of debate. And the National Examiner in D.C., actually, which is the you know, number one paper in D.C. at the time, only covers this in one paragraph. So you see basically Claiborne's led, you know, narrative strategy of minimizing these events to be very successful.
And that gets back to, again, as we discussed a little bit earlier, they certainly wanted to, they didn't, no one in the South would have wanted this story to get out and for other slaves to take that as an example and inspiration. So part of the reason for wanting to dampen down the story would just be that, but also the people there in Louisiana were wanting to put the rest of the country at ease about Louisiana and have and so they were saying the rest of the country, no, really, it's everything's fine here, everything's under control here. You don't have to worry about us, Louisiana. We're doing just fine.
Exactly, and actually, interestingly enough, throughout the South, Southern newspapers take the story. We know when the boats sort of came in, and so when they would have received that story, and they sit on it for months because they don't want to publish that story so soon after the revolt, for fear that their slaves would gain inspiration immediately. So they wait until they're totally confident that New Orleans is secure before they reprint those publications and before they tell their citizens in Charleston and elsewhere that the revolt happened.
Well, we're just about at the time that we've used our time. I explained at the beginning that you started doing in the investigation here, sort of doing the research, when you were an undergrad at Harvard and wrote about this and then expanded the story, did some more work on it, so we have the book American Uprising. I don't believe you're working as an historian now. Is this something that you think that you're going to continue to do, write about things like this?
You know, I would love to, and right now I'm sort of, you know, looking for, you know, another topic and something that will speak to me like this one did. You know, but it's a long commitment to write a book, and so I want to make sure that I found a topic that really does work and that is important and that, you know, makes a contribution before I start in on writing the next book.
And there any likely candidates at this point for you?
I have a few ideas, but nothing that I'm you know, ready to speak about yet.
I see. And is it about this same time period, or
yeah,
is it even,
yeah.
So it's essentially the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, for people who are interested in reading the story, and it is a good story, you can look for the book that we have talked about. The title is American Uprising, and the subtitle is The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt by our guest, Daniel Rasmussen, and the book is published by Harper, and you can find it now out in the bookstores. And thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate
it. Thank you. It's been a pleasure being on, David. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
It's 11:58 with this market update. I'm Tom Rogers in advance of the afternoon magazine coming up after NPR News. Down is the key word on the markets today. Cattle seem to be the only thing bucking the downward trend, a lot of it due to a falling price of oil. Corn had fallen at one point down a 30-cent limit to its lowest price since last March. Wheat and soy are sharply lower on the wake of this morning's USDA reports that came out. The Kansas City May winter wheat contract is down 10.5 cents at the moment at 922. That hasn't traded for a while, though. July wheat down 25 at 903.5. On the Chicago Mercantile Exchange grain side, May wheat is at 740 a bushel. That's off 29 cents. July down 28.5 at 770.25. Nearby corn for both the May and July contracts are right now down the 30-cent limit. May at 676, July at 677.25, September corn down 26.75 at 654.5, Dease corn down 24 at 628.75. The big loser, crude oil, right now down more than $5 a barrel, down 512 right now at 98.77. RBOB gasoline 308.1, that's down almost 23 cents. May soybeans right now down 20 at 13.20. July down 15 and a quarter at 13.22 and three quarters. August right now 13.22 and a half, down 14 and a half. September 13.14 and a half, down 15 and a quarter. November 13.11 and a quarter, down 11 and a quarter. May bean meal 3.41, down 5.30. Bean oil for May 56 even, down 49. Live cattle up 40 at 109.57 and a half. Lean hogs down a nickel for May at 92 even. The Dow now down 146 points at 12,614. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Forecast calls for a high of 89, partly sunny this afternoon, chance of showers and thunderstorms.